You're tuned in to the Vintage House Show, home to the original stories of the history of house music as told by the legends, pioneers, and icons. Hosted by Kevin Mega McFall, Lori Branch, and Lauren Lowry.
In this fantastic episode of the Vintage House Show podcast, DJ Wayne Williams, the founder of the Chosen Few DJ Collective, and Kirk Townsend, the founder of the Mendel Bi-Level Disco Parties, speak at the Chicago Public Library Summer 2023. Listen and share the Vintage House Show at vintagehouseshow.tv.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming out for this wonderful panel discussion with two legends of Chicago house music. Can we all give them a hand for even coming out? In this heat, they come out and they stuck to their commitment, and I am so grateful because I really respect both of these men and Lauren, our moderator, who is also exceptional. So I want you guys to come out, listen to some history, true history, from two original pioneers of Chicago house music, a genre known across the world as one of the greatest genres that these men were pivotal in helping create. So let's start our panel discussion, and I'm gonna kick it over to Lauren, and then we'll introduce our panelists. All right.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Marcus, for allowing both of these legends to come and talk about this important genre of black music history. My name is Lauren Lowry. Thank you all so much for coming to the library today to hear from these men about their significant impact on the history of black music, number one. I am Lauren. I am an author, archivist, historian, and I'm also the executive producer of a show called The Vintage House Show. We celebrate and preserve the history of house music and its culture and its pioneers. We want to know their stories. Check us out at thevintagehouseshow.com, .tv, and on the air, 89.3 FM, WNUR. Again, thank you all for coming today. You all should know that you all are learning today about house music from the pioneers of the genre. These gentlemen were there before it was house music, when it became house music, and they're continuing to ensure that this music lives on forever. House music is Chicago history. It is black history. It is Chicago black history. This is why this is so important that we continue to talk about and preserve. Before we talk about, I'm going to say, sort of the pivotal role that these speakers have contributed to, what they've done with the music and for the genre, I'm going to give you all a quick Chicago introduction, and then we're going to allow them to do their own introductions. Kirk Townsend, the gentleman to my right, is a Chicago native, a former tour manager, a radio personality, and famously the founder of the Mendel Catholic Bi-Level Dance Parties. He was there at the beginning of those forms, of those, the beginning of that event. He created that event. He did that event for 12 years, if I'm not mistaken. How long was that event? About 12 years?
Yeah.
Raised almost, if not more than, $15 million for Mendel Catholic High School to survive during that time. While doing that, he's also creating and supporting the careers of many of the people like Jesse Saunders, like Wayne Williams, like Jamie Principle, like Frankie Knuckles. He brought all those people to Mendel and to other places, so his story is critical. And as we think about the history of house music, please welcome Kirk Townsend.
Thank you, Lauren. Welcome, everybody. First, I want to thank Marcus Barrett, who is the branch manager here at Greater Grand Crossing, and who came up with this concept. And I want to thank somebody else who isn't here today. I thought he would be here. He is also a true pioneer in the music industry, he and his dad. And that's Ray Barney. Ray Barney and his dad had Barney's One Stop, which was a huge black distributorship. So, you know, you had your Ma and Pa record stores where they would all go to the distributors, like Barney's One Stop or Fletcher's One Stop and I know a lot of you guys might have gone to Renaissance, the club down there on 46 and King Drive, but when you park on that vacant lot, there was a building that stood there before they tore it down, and that was two brothers, the Lehner brothers, who had probably the largest black distributorship of music in the city. So it's a lot of history we can go through and a lot of stuff, but giving a shout out to Ray, I guess he met Marcus or somehow it happened, and Ray told him, this is the brother you should call if you want to know the story. So here we are, and I'm so happy to do this with the Public Library System.
Thank you so much, Kirk. I will now introduce DJ Wayne Williams, also a Chicagoan and founder of the Chosen Few DJs Collective and the Chosen Few DJs Picnic and Music Festival, which is now over 30 years old, 31, 32 years old, and brings in 30 to 50,000 people annually to the city of Chicago to enjoy house music birthed here in the city of Chicago. Besides that, Wayne Williams also is a music industry professional, from Trax Records to Jive Records to Senior VP of A&R at RCA Records. Dr. Derelict here, which was an alias back in the day, is pivotal also to the business of house music. So not only is he an artist and a creative, but he contributed to the business, how people make money in this industry, and how maybe some other people don't make money in this industry. He has that background and that knowledge. So first, I'm going to start with Kirk. You know, at the Vintage House Show, we believe in starting from the beginning. You know, what are those influences that allowed you to become the pioneer that you are today? So we're going to start, I'm going to have you tell me your Chicago story, Kirk. So I know sort of, you know, it starts somewhere and it ends at Mendel, as we're thinking about your young years. But talk to me about the beginning, where you grew up, the community you grew up in, high schools, grammar schools, and what were those music influences?
God, we moved a lot. I majorly grew up in Woodlawn, and then we ended up moving to, I guess that would be Washington Heights for a short period of time, and then back to South Shore, where I remained for a great majority of my life. And when I was a young guy, one of the first influences that probably got me hit with the bug was my dad was a bowler at Starlight Bowling Alley that was at 87th and Cottage Grove. And he bowled in Daddy O'Daly's Sunday Mornings Men's League. And in case you didn't know who Daddy O'Daly was, he was one of the first black radio announcers in the city of Chicago, along with Herb Kent and Al, oh God, I just remembered.
Al Benson.
Thank you. Al Benson, Purvis Man, you know. Al Benson was first. And so they all pulled their money together and a bunch of black guys bought a bowling alley. And so on Sunday mornings, they would have a DJ play jazz music while the guys bowled. And one of the other guys that bowled with my dad was Tony Hatchett Sr. So Tony and Andre and myself, we'd all be running around Starlight on Sundays, you know, running around with kids. And we watched this guy named Miller Green, who was playing the music. And sometimes he would let Andre get behind the box. So Andre was like 7, 8 years old, going behind and playing records and stuff. So, and it was like, I wasn't that deep yet. And so then once I got more involved, come on in. Once I got more involved, I was in eighth grade at Holy Cross High School. Grammar School. And one of my buddies there, Kenny Anderson, his father, George Anderson, was the engineer at Soul Train. Soul Train was still being filmed here in the Board of Trade building down on Jackson. And we would jump on the L sometimes, the Green Line, and just run down and watch his dad engineering the records and how they would just do everything. The magic that creates once you put a record on and how everybody just reacts and you take them on this journey. And that always intrigued me. And then we had our eighth grade dance, and George came out and DJed our eighth grade dance and brought the Soul Train dancers with him. Come on now, we were like in heaven. We were in this little small Catholic grammar school.
What school was that?
Holy Cross. Holy Cross Grammar School. And so we're watching them DJ, and he's got everybody dancing, and he's got everybody up and going. And next thing you know, he did something that blew my mind. And I had never seen this or witnessed this before. He said, we're going to do a ladies' choice. And he allowed all the women in the Soul Train dancers to get up and go get the guys from the grammar school to dance with. Because everybody's, we were down there playing with each other most of the time, hitting each other. But he got us more involved with it. And then that showed me how the DJ really involves people and gravitates to them, and you know, you can take them along with you. And the famous, God knows I remember her name, Soul Train dancer, this young lady, she came and got me, and I'm gonna age myself now. We danced to Sexy Mama by the Moments. I was done. I'm like, this can happen by playing a record? Oh, no. So, I was already working at McDonald's. I was one of the youngest assistant managers in McDonald's history at 14. And so I had, you know, money. I was buying my own clothes. I was doing my thing. And I started buying more and more equipment. And I got into a record pool. And I started getting records. And I was DJing parties first for my dad's friends, like jazz records, because I was just emulating what I saw Miller do. And then once I saw a different plot and the music I was getting, it started me on playing different genres of music and playing for larger groups. And once we did that, I was doing like the Ladies with Class parties, the Roberts 500 Room, you know, bigger parties and stuff like that, and kept growing and growing and growing. And then I went to De La Salle in my freshman year because I was an athlete. I had a football scholarship to go there, and hated it, absolutely hated it.
Why did you hate it? What was going on in De La Salle?
Well, De La Salle in 1973, 74 was mostly the kids from Bridgeport, Canaryville. I mean, it was just one bastion of hatred. I mean, when you walk in every day, you can like cut it with a knife, it was so thick. And you know, to be called nigga on a daily basis, you know, was just, I'm like, I gotta leave here. Either I'm gonna kill somebody or somebody gonna kill me. So it's best I go. And I was gonna go to CVS and take a tray. And my mom kept messing around, because we weren't quite at the border to go to CVS. And I wasn't going to South Shore. And she said, I'll never forget a Sunday I was going to work. No offense, Odie.
My buddy Odie. I'm about to say Kirk, come on in.
So a Sunday I was going to work, and I kept bothering her. You know, we got to find somebody's address we can use so I can get in. She said, don't worry about it. I put you in Mendo, you're going tomorrow. You take this bus, this train, this bus, you get off, you walk down the thing. If you come to White Castle, you went the wrong direction, turn around and go back another direction. My buddy Will is here wearing his Monarch gear, so I wanted to shout him out too. But I said, Mendo, I had no idea what Mendo was, where it was. And she said, you'll love it. It's a beautiful campus. It's got a pond out front and a fountain and flowers. I don't want to offend anybody, so what kind of kiddie school you got here? Flowers and ponds and fountains. And let me tell you, when God puts you where you're supposed to be, from day one, I got in there and the theology teacher, Father Dan O'Grady, was also the activities director. He was responsible for doing activities to raise money for the school. And he said, the first thing he said, when you come back tomorrow, bring a shoebox. And in it, I want you to put things to represent your life. I said, okay, we're going to do a little show and tell type deal. So I put in a little McDonald's patch that was on my shoulder, so I was wearing a manager shirt. And then I put a 45 spindle in there. And go back the next day, and he says, well, what are these for? I said, well, you know the McDonald thing, because all my boys were starting to call me Ron McDonald by then. And so he said, well, what's this? I said, it's a 45 spindle. I'm a DJ, and, you know, I've been DJing a lot of different parties and gaining popularity. And he said, well, we do about 4 or 5 dances a year. You know, and we could try you out. There's a couple of DJs here already, but, you know, I said, oh, no problem. And they tried me out the first one in the homecoming dance. I was in the basement. And next thing you know, everybody started gravitating towards down there. And I ran the guys out and went to Father Brady and said, you know what, this is a situation where we could really do well, you know, by doing this weekly, you know, because of the unique setup of Mendel's gym. It was above the cafeteria, and it was three ways up and down. So it was a constant flow of people. You can listen to two different DJs. I've heard people refer to it as the first rave party because of the flow. And so this is like in 75. By the middle of 76, we were starting to average like 1,500 people a week. And by the end of 76, we were upward 2,000 kids every Saturday night. And some Fridays when we did psychops after the, and it was mostly due to the marketing things that I bought for the different schools, getting discounts, and, you know, all the different marketing ploys that you use to do different things. And the rest was history. But the important thing I want to stress is that it happened during a time where at the crux of Mendel, there was probably 1,900 students there. And when I got there in 75, it was maybe down about 1,700. And maybe still 60% white. My graduating class in 78 was the first all-black graduating class with a little under 900 students. So not only did the parties start bringing people from all around the city to the different, the revenue created by the dances literally kept the doors of the school open, which they were going to shut down in 1979 because they couldn't see themselves operating a plant that big on 900 students, where they were used to doing it, at 1,900 students. And they finally saw no other real way of raising. There were so many donuts and world's finest chocolate and raffles you can do. You know, they needed something that would create revenue. And we came up with it. And literally, when the school turned all black, I'm proud that I was able to bring the revenue in that literally kept the school open for 12 years.
That is amazing. Story. Thanks so much for talking about the LaSalle, because it's important to understand why you moved and the importance of your mom telling you to go there, because you changed music history in doing that. So thank your mom every day for that. Wayne Williams, please talk to me about your trajectory to Kenwood and your musical influences along the way.
What's funny is the reason he left Do the South is the reason I left Mendel.
Which is important to know.
So, yeah, because I went to Mendel first. I started DJing. My sister's boyfriend was a DJ. He went to Do the South. And she's 3 years older than me. And so my mother would make me go with her, kind of like chaperone, because he used to give basement parties. And so I went, and they would be all slow dancing, and this back in the day when there's only one turntable, right? And so when the record went off, I was back there, so I put the next record on, and I saw how they reacted to the record I chose. And I was like, wow. You know, and that's what gave me the bug to DJ. So that was 1973. In 1974, I was in grammar school, 8th grade, and I went to St. Catherine's in general. And unlike her...
St. Catherine's, by the way?
Hmm?
Okay.
117th and Love. And unlike Kurt, I knew all about Mendel because, my sister's boyfriend was a D. LaSalle, so they would play their games at Gailey Stadium, and I would go there. And I would watch the games, and I was on the D. LaSalle side because that's the side they were on. But I saw there was more energy, even though they were a worse football team, right? There was more energy on the Mendel side. Right, and that caught my attention. I was like, "Oh man, that school got a lot of, it's got a lot of good school spirit, right?" And so, I literally took two tests. I took one for Quigley South, and I took one for Mendel, and I scored a really high on the Mendel one. And so, but my guys in grammar school, Bob Peters, Quinnell Cooper, they were my buddies, and so we all wanted to go to Mendel. And I was living in West Pullman at the time, 120th and LaSalle, which is that area anyway. And so we would just all talk about going to Mendel. And so my freshman year, you know, we get to Mendel, and they had a unusual welcoming ceremony at Mendel, where the seniors would throw the freshmen in the pond, in the water, right? And I guess, you know, because, again, we were probably one of the first mostly black classes my freshman year in 1974. So I guess, you know, the white guys used to do that all the time, but throwing black guys in water, that's not a cool thing to do, you know? And so it became a big thing because, you know, we was fighting back. The other guys would just let them do it. No, we, huh? No, you know, so that got to be a big deal. And then one time I was in, there was a algebra class, a teacher, Father Timer, and he called me in the classroom.
Wait a minute. So you're saying a teacher, one of your teachers.
A priest. Yeah. And so, you know. I told him, so, you know, in so many words, I told him I didn't appreciate that. And I chose the wrong words, so I immediately went to the principal's office. And then the principal made probably the biggest mistake in his life, right? Because the first thing they do is they call your parents. And my mom was militant, right? I mean, she was a Black Panther. She every Saturday she worked at Operation Pusher Forever, Willie Barrow. And so they came in and they had separated us, and they told her, like, you know, I went off on the priest or whatever, but they forgot one thing, right? And so when she came in and said, and asked me what happened, I told her. And so she said, okay, honey, stay right there. And then she went back in there, and needless to say, I was out of Mendel. You know, it kicked us both out. Let me put it that way. and that's how I ended up in Kenwood. Yeah. But I definitely, that time I was there, you know, I enjoyed Mendel. And like I said, at that time, all of my boys went to Mendel. So even though I was going to Kenwood at the time, I would always be up at Mendel. Plus, it was close to my my house, you know. And so when Kirk got there and with the dances and started the dances, you know, I would go up to the dances, you know. It's interesting that you have us both on a panel, and I was just thinking about that. Even listening to Kirk, you know, I found out things just now that I wasn't even aware of. And quite frankly, and you know, I'm not an egotistical person, but I will say this. It's amazing that the two of us, for the first time, are on a panel together, talking about the history of house music when we were literally there at the beginning of the culture, right? And and we got receipts. Let me put it that way, right? We got receipts. So this is going to be a very entertaining discussion. Let me just say that.
Yeah, it's critical that you tell those stories. These stories are critical. We are gonna. This is gonna be about an hour or 15-minute discussion, and then we'll have questions after that. By the way, and if you're not one of those people who likes to get up and ask questions, we do have some cards over there. You can write your questions down, bring them to me. I'm happy to ask those questions. But
we don't need no stinking cards to get up and ask your questions.
Some people don't like doing that. Just like someone else did that. But guys, yeah.
I just wanna say thank you to you all for the way you put that out there, because it's such a tie-in to house music. I'm 58 now. House music and liberation and church and Catholic school, Corpus Christi, St. Anselm, Aquinas Catholic. My mother finally pulled me out, and there was liberation and there was house music at the same time. So, thank you for what you all do.
Yeah, thank you. So we'll talk starting from Mendel and starting from Kenwood. You said your earliest sort of influences, you were playing jazz. And so let's sort of bring ourselves to the point where, jazz is turning into funk, is turning into disco, is turning into house, and the influences. How did that progression lead for you from jazz to wherever you started at Mendel?
That's a very good question. And I'm going to not only tell you how, but I'm going to show you how. So in 74, I'm doing these parties. Again, I did it because it was easier for me to emulate what I was watching Miller do on Sundays. But then I realized Miller was playing songs like Harlem, Bill Withers. Because this is like 1970. So when these records first came out, and if you think about it now, and you go to any house party, you're bound to hear Harlem. Some 60-some years later.
Yeah.
And I say that to say how cyclical everything is in the industry. It's always cyclical. Fashion, cultures, different things. It always goes in circles, and it all comes back around. When I started playing stuff like that, and like when Isaac Hayes' album Chocolate Chip came out, and I'm playing I Can't Turn Around.
Yeah.
But I'm also playing the ballad on there too, A Few More Kisses to Go, because Wayne and I had this conversation once about the lost art of slow dancing. And back then, it was just a big of a part of playing in the culture. Because most people went out to the parties, especially at Mendel, because we were known to have all the fine women at Mendel, it was your chance to go get your Mac on, dude. It's now or never. So, but it was just a bigger part of the reality of it as a whole. So now you move into the R&B portion of it. But the jazz portion of it, the jazz created a lot of the disco stuff. Look at MFSB, Love is the Message, Bohannon. This was stuff prior to house music. I'm playing this stuff in 74 as new records, and then 20 years later, they're house records. So you see the cycle in which it comes back around, and it just keeps going from there. Now, true disco in a lot of different forms started hitting the marketplace maybe in like 75, maybe, on a large scale. I mean, obviously people are doing the tramps, that's where the happy people go. And we're playing a lot of, but these were just brand new records I'm playing for my constituents. The problem, you can just go on forever. And then you see how it starts to transpose itself from R&B to disco, and from disco, you got to throw in a little gospel to house.
You all did.
And that's the formula right there.
With black music, we like to start with gospel, and then everything starts to trickle.
Oh, absolutely. And remember, jazz is the only true American art form created by black people, as well as the blues.
Yes.
So that's our music. So it, whenever it morphed, it would morph into different aspects of it. And it's not surprising to me that it would end up in certain aspects the way it did.
Wayne, talk to us, about your sort of music history. I've heard your story many times, but at 13 years old, what are you saying? You're DJing, and that's pretty early. And then also, when you talk to me also about, like, you said you were supervising, you were chaperoning your sister, who was younger, was older than you. So the younger brother is chaperoning the older sister at a party. How is that? Like, talk to me about sort of how at 13 you have the ability to be a chaperone to an older sister, and then those influences around music that led to you at 13 spinning.
Well, I'll start with the chaperone first. So it was either two things. Now, mind you, I'm 13, right? So, I'm following what my mother tells me to do, right? And she either, it's 1973, and girls didn't go to guys' houses, in my family, let me put it that way, right? Girls didn't go to guys. My mother wasn't about that, right? Go to guys, even if it was her boyfriend. I mean, they were 16 now, right? And still, that's young, And to go to a party over a guy's house who's giving a basement party in his house, she wanted her, her brother to go with,
Were you tall?
Her son to go with.
Like an older man, or like? Because when you talk to someone at 13, your sister's still towering over you. Is a 13-year-old going to be aggressive enough to be sort of a chaperone? Were you a tall young man at 13?
I was tall for my age, but...
And he was 13 in 1938.
And I, here we go. I was, athletic. I played basketball and ran track and stuff like that. And... But it was either that or she wanted us both out of the house, so let me put it that way. But I think that it was she wanted me to look after my sister. Because she was very, my mother was strict, I had a very strict mother. And so that part. So the music, I think, is my dad, who was kind of in and out of my life. My mother raised me. But my dad would come in and out. But he loved jazz, and he was into Count Basie and Jimmy Smith and Sarah Vaughan and Oscar Peterson and Jimmy Smith. So he really liked that kind of jazz. And my mother, she liked Motown. She liked Aretha Franklin, soul artists, And every Saturday morning we had to clean the house to the Aretha Franklin album that she did with her dad, James.
Cleveland.
James Cleveland, yeah. And
the music.
And so I knew that whole album like by heart, every song, And eventually did that song Mary Mary with Craig because it caught that experience. But those are my musical influences, but I listen to the radio every day. I listen to WLS, I listen to WGRT, and I listen to WVON. Those were the three radio stations that were my mainstay. And I would always have the radio on, I knew the jocks, like Herb Ken and Larry Lou Jack, and all the jocks, but I love music. And that was, I would buy the albums, I would collect records. Even before I even started DJing, I collected records. And so I think one of the first records I ever bought was like Dennis Coffee, a Scorpio. And so I think that record came out in 72. Yeah, so, but anyway, that was my musical introduction.
Thanks for listening to the Vintage House Show podcast. Please subscribe and share, and check us out live, WNUR 89.3 FM, Wednesdays at 10 o'clock.